good evening. At this time, Mel and Dick begin the TechNet. For those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is a gathering of the clan in which we share information about how to get more enjoyment out of this hobby of ham radio. A little bit on the complicated side, ham radio it is. There's 26 or so different kinds of ham radio. The 2-meter FM repeater work you're listening to right now is just one of the 26 kinds. We try to discuss some of the other 25. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this. N2EO, Rich and Yes. Do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
To me, it's YYY. Joe. Yes.
Okay, I heard Joe, W-E-2-R-Y-Y. I heard another man on the input who doesn't have a PL tone, therefore he didn't come through the machine. So you want to check in again?
WB2-QEQ, Len, yes.
We got Len. Were you the guy that signed in earlier, Len?
That's a negative.
Okay, there was another person who signed in, other than Joe and Len, who didn't have a PL, so I heard him on the input, but it didn't catch his call. Want to try again? Okay, anyone else to check in besides Len and Joe? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WB2QGZ, Bill, quick comment to follow up on something we talked about last week.
Bill recognized. And anyone else?
KP1NNH, Jerry, no question.
Good evening, K2KEY.
Okay, Jerry with a no, and Mel with a yes. Anyone else?
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Okay, Steve recognized. Anyone else? One of the things that I've recognized about ham radio operators in particular, and about anyone who is going to make any technological progress, because it takes curiosity. That's how mankind generally makes progress, by displaying curiosity. From time to time, you'll hear people ask questions on the TechNet, maybe in the process of trying to develop a product, and sometimes the questions will seem a little bit on the strange side, maybe a little bit far-fetched, but if you're doing research and development, the whole idea of doing it in the first place is you don't have an answer. You're trying to make things work, so to speak. So if you're really pushing the envelope, occasionally you're going to be working on some things that don't work out the way you expect them to. Let's see what Bill's got to say with reference to last week's discussion. We had a significant discussion last week on the inner workings of cell phones and how it can possibly be applied to another service. And maybe it's a bit of a long shot, maybe if it's a bit of a dark horse, that I guess it was Alex that was pursuing it, but still, that's how progress is made. Try everything, so to speak. WB2QGZ, go right ahead, Bill. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening. I'm still a little intrigued by what Glenn was seeing when he was looking at his phone with the spec in, indicating that he seemed to see some kind of continuous duty transmission out of it, because I have dug through a whole bunch of stuff I have sitting here in front of me, and with the exception of when you go to initiate a phone call, or if you're running some kind of Java app on the phone, which gets autonomous control of your transmitter in the phone to send data back to someone or to request data, your phone cannot talk unless the system tells it to, even in registration. So one way or another, depending on how your carrier has it set up, you know, you're only waking up for a page slot that's 80 milliseconds long every so often. So one way or another, even if you were, in other words, I can't see that continuous receive that he was seeing, where he was seeing that emission, or that continuous transmitter signal that he was seeing in his phone. Because even if, in other words, one way or another, it's still got to be bouncing up and down for that to reduce the duty cycle. And when we think about it, if phone was indeed transmitting continuously, the battery life would be pretty close to zero, and we can figure that because if the phone is out of range of a cell site, it has no downlink, it's going to be in a much higher duty cycle of receive trying to find a system, and that's where you find these guys in the basement out of range with the batteries to die in 2 hours. Now, if it was transmitting, it would eat that battery up in no time. And the second thing is, from the system operator point of view, if you can support 20, 30 calls per channel per sector in CDMA approximately, my stab at it, that means you're probably supporting 300 or 400 subscribers per sector, and there'd be no place to put them. So I have not sat down yet with one of my phones and a spec in here to see if I'm emitting something continuously, but I don't know, I'm kind of intrigued by what was coming out of that phone. Back to you.
Yeah, Glenn hasn't signed in yet, KC2QIQ, but when he does, I guess we've got to ask him further information about what brand of phone, what brand of service, and so on he's using, and what did he exactly see? Was he looking at a local oscillator of a receiver? Was he really looking at a transmission? What kind of power, flux density was he observing, and so on? I wonder if Glenn is on frequency. KC2QIQ, are you there, Glenn? K2RIW? Okay, maybe Glenn's not there yet. But when he does, I think we gotta pick his brain a little bit more. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, I'm just intrigued by what he might have been seeing out of there. That's sort of interesting to me. And, you know, even if it was LO, the LO should be working at that same duty cycle. So that's what's weird. But anyway, that's it. Carry on. WB2QG, that'll be good listening.
Okay, that was our old business. And now we're going to start on some new business. Len, I think you were the first person who signed in. I think you had a yes. WB2QEQ, go right ahead with your question, Len. K2RIW.
I was number one.
Rich, somebody jump in there? I don't know. This is WB2QEQ. Am I still on?
You are, Len. Joe, we're going to get you right after Len. Go ahead, Len.
Okay, I won't tie it up too long. Question. Because of constrictions for room, I'm contemplating using a screwdriver antenna as a base antenna. And I can mount it either on the ground in the yard or maybe up on a pole or perhaps on top of the garage. The question I have is about counterpoise and radials. Most of these companies that sell this product are not too forthcoming with information. I'm just wondering if one is better than the other, ground, pole, or on top of the garage. And will I need counterpoise or radials? You got any views on that? I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I've got some views on that one, Len. And I think part of why you're getting so little information from the screwdriver manufacturer is that they've designed an antenna that I believe has been designed to be connected to the bumper, the metallic bumper of a full-sized automobile. And they have tuned the antenna for that as a counterpoise. Far from ideal, but it's all you've got when it comes to mobile operation. On, let's say, 80 meters, you don't have the real estate to lay down a bunch of ground plane radials that are 67 feet long. You have to just do with what you can do. And so the automobile, being very undersized in its ground plane radial system, is going to represent quite a significant capacitive reactance. And they probably tune the antenna accordingly to compensate for that. When it comes to 80-meter operation, you, without a doubt, are going to have to put some ground plane radials down. And altitude always helps. So therefore, if the antenna is on top of the garage versus the ground, it is my belief you're going to get more performance. I think you should put down a minimum of 3 or 4 radials, and more would help. And if you can make them as long as 67 feet, that's good. If you can't make them that long because you don't have the real estate, try it anyhow, because it works with an automobile, which is a hell of a lot less size of ground plane. But every quarter wave resonant antenna does need a counterpoise. It needs a mirror image, because the quarter wave ground plane is only half the antenna. A full antenna is a dipole, where there's a quarter wave resonator on one side of the feed point and a quarter wave resonant metallic object on the other side. That's a full half-wave dipole. In the case of a ground plane antenna, by mirror image into the radial system, you're trying to create the equivalent of the other half. Without that, you're going to get a very hot cable and extremely high standing wave ratio. It's going to require some experimentation. And if you've got an antenna tuner, I know you can make it work. Without an antenna tuner, it's going to be a little bit troublesome. You're going to exceed 2-to-1 standing wave ratio very fast. Now, it seems to me like we've had the screwdriver question on, I guess it was a person who signed in last week or 2 weeks ago who wanted to use a screwdriver antenna within their apartment, and a similar requirement is going to be...
Repeater, timeout.
There's a similar requirement for the ground plane radial system. Now, within the sound of my voice, has anyone who can tell us some real experience where they have used a screwdriver antenna mounting in any place other than an automobile where it was designed for? What did you do? How did you make it work? How successful was it? And if anyone else has any other screwdriver information, please give us your call letters right now. KQIW on the TechNet.
KC2 QIQ, good evening, Dick.
Okay, I'm hearing KC2 QIQ, and I'm hearing another voice. Who was the other voice?
2KEY.
Okay, Mel. We'll take Glenn and Mel in that order. And Glenn, as you probably heard earlier, Bill's going to have some further questions for you. So, what have you done with a screwdriver, Glenn? KC2 QIQ, go right ahead.
Yeah, I experimented with the screwdriver using the Tar Heel antenna. Using it on my Jeep Cherokee, it worked very, very good, and on a couple of other vehicles, had excellent performance. In a base station application, what I find is that you can tune it with a counterpoise, but unfortunately the kind of results that you have is completely different from what you'd see inside the automobile. In other words, if you tune a counterpoise for a specific frequency, it'll work well. But if you try to change frequency in bands like you would normally do in an automobile, you have to keep on changing the counterpoise in order to, get it to work on more than one frequency. Or you can probably tune it counterpoise to cover maybe one band, which is relatively narrow for the full swing that you'd see normally out of one of these screwdriver antennas. But unfortunately, I don't think I haven't been able to successfully come up with a counterpoise yet that would work for all multiband use.
Well, I'm pretty sure Len would like to know how many ground plane radials of what length did you lay down? Did you lay down some ground plane radials that are the right length for 80 meters and some others for 40 meters, other for 20 meters? What exactly did you do, and how poorly did it work? What kind of biswa did you see? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I have pretty much a full backyard worth of ground radial system that I put in little by little. And when the antenna is almost at ground level, in other words, if you take a piece of pipe and you hammer it into the ground and you get the screwdriver antenna just above the ground radial system at ground level, it'll tune pretty wide. The problem is when you try to elevate it on a pipe or some extension to get it above there, the length of the pipe tends to cause an additional tuning and detunes the screwdriver antenna, and the bandwidth becomes really, really narrow.
Now, what Glenn is thinking of doing is putting the whole screwdriver antenna on top of the roof and putting the ground plane radials at that altitude, not at ground level. I suspect that's going to work a lot better. What do you think, Glenn?
I think if it's going to have a chance, that's the only way it's going to work. But I don't know what this would have to look like and how large a system it would be. I'd be interested in the results of how that one turns out, but I think at that point in time, if you're going to go that elaborate, there's a lot of other vertical antennas that would probably work a whole lot better.
I bet you this problem has already been solved by that Kings County Radio Club group. They've been doing shootouts of all kinds of antennas for quite a few years. I bet you the screwdriver is one of them. K2KEY, tell us about that, Mel. K2RIW.
Yep, been there. What I've done, Dick, this is K2KEY. I had the idea some years ago that I wanted to have as a second antenna, like a backyard area and all, a vertical, utilize the a mobile antenna. I happened to have one mobile antenna that was electrically switchable that was made by Master Mobile many years ago. Now, what I did, before I put the new roof on the garage, I had a lot, as I mentioned before, a lot of copper screening. Tremendous amount that I got really for nothing here just by scavenging, as you know. And I laid that copper screening on the garage roof and covered the entire garage roof with it and then laid the new shingles on it, on top of it. And I thought I would use that, you know, as a counterpoise. It should work effectively like an automobile. But no way. I experienced something like Glenn was saying. It was good for certain frequent certain bands, but not overall what I would expect. Got much better results out of a standard vertical, Dick. Over.
Now, when you put down the screening on the garage roof, I am guessing your garage is nowhere near as large as 67 feet to the right and 67 feet to the left, so to speak. So in other words, a 130-foot long roof. So therefore, wavelength-wise, your screening, although it's a very significant counterpoise, wasn't the right electrical length. I'm suspecting that if you had put down some radial wires of the right length, you would have gotten more performance, even though that screening, as a diagram on a piece of paper, looks like it should be very substantial. I wonder if you think there's any truth in what I just said, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, I was trying to mimic the effect that it has on an automobile. In other words, I envisioned that the car goes in the garage, you know, the area, in fact, with the screening actually encompassed more area than the than an automobile. So I was actually, you know, visualizing that the screening would act like my car, that I used the Husqvarna whip on the car, which seems to be pretty good. I mean, I've had very good results using the Hustler whip. I've used a couple different antennas, but I found the Hustler seems to work the best. You know, it's a pain in the neck, of course. You got to have to change bands. You got to unscrew the resonator and put on another resonator. But I tried several mobile antennas. I had a Master Mobile. I had a Tar Heel, one of Tar Heel types that a friend of mine had that I borrowed. And about three, four different antennas, but even though I thought, gee, the screening should really mimic maybe the car's body, it still never really worked the way I wanted it to, Dick, over.
Well, you say it didn't work the way you wanted it to, Mel. What are we talking about here? A 3-to-1 standing wave ratio on certain ends of certain bands? What's your definition of not working so well?
Nothing, I should say, 40 meters, 80 meters, not anything to consider as a, in fact, the Hustler mobile antenna, even though its tuning range on 75 meters or 40 meters is, you know, very small before the FWR takes off, you know, ridiculously high. On the garage roof, it seemed to be even worse. Could it be that the mass of the screen, copper screening, is not the equivalent to the mass of the car? So maybe that's the variable, Dick, over.
KC2, QAQ.
Yeah, Glenn recognized there's another couple of variables here, and that is the car is close to the ground and your screening was very far above the ground on the roof of your building. When you say you weren't happy with the results, does that mean that the minimum VISWR wasn't good enough, or that the antenna was much too narrow band? Which complaint did you have, Mel, first? Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, let's say how high it is. The garage roof is not that high. I mean, it's, I'd say the garage roof is 10, 12 feet high. Yeah, maybe 12 feet high. The peak of it would be maybe in the garage. Yeah, 12 feet, no more than 12 feet. As far, what would I say was the performance like? I would say the performance was very marginal, that besides the FWR loading situation was somewhat erratic. I just didn't seem to get the reports that I expected. I figured it'd be compatible to say when I have it on a car in a fairly decent location. Now, this is not a bad location I have here. Yes, it's between houses and things, but mostly in the open. But I overall did not get the performance, Dick, in every which way, whether it be loading or what I expected to see, like, you know, a little better than a QRP type of operation. Over.
Okay. I hear you. It does sound like it was disappointing. Let's see what Glenn's got to say on all of this. KC2QIQ, go right ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, actually, the only thing I didn't experiment with, I did extend the counterpoises to fixed lengths, and they pretty much calculate out to quarter waves. So in other words, if you come up with a quarter wave equivalent length for any specific frequency that you're at, it seems to tune down. Now, one of the things I tried doing was fanning, like creating some kind of like a fanned counterpoise coming off the bottom. And that also, but it did work, but, you know, it gave like a real ripply effect. You see, one of the nice things about having an auto-tunable or infinitely adjustable antenna like that is that you're adjusting the coil, and as you move to different frequencies, basically you bring the VSWR to a really nice dip, and it's a nice high Q output, and your performance is pretty good. When you try to do some kind of like a fanned, you know, dipole counterpoise kind of a thing, it really just doesn't perform as well. And as I said, before I could actually get the performance to something similar as a car, I had to actually almost bring it down to ground level and pretty much see it right on top of a counterpoised ground plane, right at the ground level. And then it would pretty much tune pretty well. But once you start elevating it in the air, it just has like an imbalanced kind of tuning, and you're lucky if you can find spots that are, you know, 3 to 1 VSWR, and it's just all over the place. One idea I never tried was actually to take two of them and tune two of them simultaneously and have basically one being one end of the dipole, the other side being the other side of the dipole. But there again, and it just becomes an extremely expensive network at that point, and I think there's far better verticals you could get at that point to could do that for kind of performance.
Okay, we've had two testimonials here, Lynn. It does sound like it's going to require some experimentation. Your mileage may differ. Your particular setup is not going to be quite the same as what Mel or Glenn have used. I think you're going to make it work, particularly if you've got an antenna tuner. With an antenna tuner, even if the VSWR is 3 to 1, that's not bad. So it sounds like you're going to go through with this experiment. Keep us informed as to what you find, how well it works or doesn't work, Lynn. WB2QEQ, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Rich, this is WB2QEQ. Thank you, and thank the other gentlemen for their help. I really appreciate it. It sounds like if I'm going to play around, I'm going to stick on the ground. You know, short of putting an old Volkswagen body up on my garage roof, it sounds like I'm going to run into a lot of problems. So I'm going to try it on the ground, or maybe, you know, a couple inches off the ground with some radials on the grass, and we'll see what happens. Thank you again, gentlemen, WB2QEQ, and whatever I come up with, I'll come back in a few weeks and let you know what's happening. Thank you again. WB2QEQ signing. 7-3, gentlemen. Thanks all around.
Very fine, Len. W-H-U-U-G-Z, I think it was, or was it QGZ? Whoever you were, go right ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. KA2UGZ, Uniform Golf Zulu. I've used the Super Antenna MP1 with its ground kit, and I usually just use the four counterpoises on the ground. It's a temporary setup, usually, and I use counterpoises that are cut for quarter wave about where I intend to operate. Not good for band switching, because I haven't tried putting multiple counterpoises on there, but I have stretched out the one for 80 and then stretched out ones for 20 and 40 and got very acceptable results without a tuner. KA2UGZ.
Okay, that's quite encouraging. Well, once again, how far above the ground did you use it? And what kind of VSWR, how low did it go, and what do you believe was the bandwidth? Go ahead.
Sure. Right on the ground, because that's how the ground kit comes. It's a little tripod, so the coil is maybe 18 inches above the ground. You do have to worry about children and pets and things touching it, but it's meant to be temporary. And I was using it on PSK and getting all over the place with it. So I really don't know how wide it was, but I was able to tune it down to below 1.5 to 1, and usually that's where I stop instead of running back and forth all the time.
And when you QSY to a new frequency within the same band, retuning the screwdriver was no problem? You almost always get the BizWire back to 1.5 again? Is that what you're saying? Go ahead.
A QSL, yeah. Not far off of that.
Okay, so Len may have an easier time than we think. Thank you very much. Joe, W2RYY, go right ahead with your question.
Good evening, Dick, W2RYY here. The question I have is on DTV converter boxes. I actually have two of them, one related to the other. I've been trying to determine the approximate sensitivity of one of these things. I did some experimentation by putting a couple of attenuator pads on the antenna line going to the box until they got to the point where the converter would actually cut off or actually make the picture break up, you know, moderately severely. And I took a spectrum analyzer trying to, you know, get an idea of what that level happened to be to try to determine what I'm actually seeing feeding into the decoder. I've used a different type of analyzer this time to measure the signal. I got readings typically about, with a pilot carrier, it's about minus 68, minus 70 on one particular frequency, which has, I believe, channel 22, digital television channel 22. But the noise floor, that I could see across the rest of the 6 meg spectrum was about 5 to 6 dB lower in the signal strength. Now, I went to another channel, the next adjacent channel, the channel DT23, which was about 8 to 10 dB stronger in signal strength. And that signal from that particular channel also broke up quite a bit. It was a little less severe, but it also broke up from time to time. Now, I'm looking at two different frequencies, but they're only 6 megs apart, but 10 dB signal in signal amplitude between one to the other. And it still causes the decoder to break up. Is there any kind of, like, level where these decoders will actually lock up on a signal completely and stay at that level? That's my first question.
Okay, here we go. Go right ahead, Eric. Glad you're here.
Yeah, I kind of walked in the middle of it, but I think I get what he's asking. Actually, there's a minimum signal strength, but the problem here is not signal strength, because what you get, the signal strength meter on the converter or receiver is really indicating signal strength plus error correction, or how hard the receiver is working or not working to correct the errors in the signal. And you can have a really weak signal that has no multipath and have it lock up and stay locked perfectly solid all the time. And you can have a really strong signal that has multipath that you can never get to lock up. So it's more than just a signal strength parameter. K2RW, K2J.
So let me probe your mind a little bit more on this one, Eric. Your experience now of aiming an antenna in various directions, picking up various digital signals, looking with I'm going to call it a diagnostic digital receiver, where you get a display of how hard all of the taps of the equalizer network, so to speak, of the digital tuner are working in order to accept all of those multipath signals, put them all back together in the time domain, add all that power together. Is there any, from your experience, is there any way that you can put into words how many nanoseconds or microseconds of delay and how much weaker is the multipath and how many multipaths? So where's the threshold of grief with, let's say, a third generation or a fifth generation tuner where even though the signals are fairly strong, the multipath problem starts dominating? Is there any way that can be put into words? I know this is a tough one, and maybe you haven't thought about it this way, and maybe there's not enough instrumentation in the world, but still, I think you might have an opinion. K2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, Dick. Since I did some research, if you remember, I sent a letter to a report to the folks that own the antenna on Empire with their particular problem. I've since learned more about the mathematics of how this whole thing works. Now, you can remember this displays that I showed you. There's a left-hand portion and a right-hand portion. My understanding of that has become much clearer. And just between you and me, one is called an FFE and one is called a DFE. And As you are aware of the various different methods of transmission, the part in the front is called a feed-forward equalizer, and it gets its information from the training signal of the pilot. So even when you have a lot of multitap, that algorithm actually does a very good job of picking out the pilot and separating stuff. The decision feedback equalizer, which is the thing that has no training, what gets its information from, is from the INQ decoder right at the back end of the IF there. That's where the improvements really start to happen. Okay, so trying to answer your question, and it dropped. There's actually two different kinds of equalization going on in the RF segment. And the ability of the mathematics of an earlier version, say a third generation equalizer, is somewhat limited by the number of bits that it can calculate and the speed at which it can calculate. Okay, a third generation equalizer, I actually found some real numbers, will withstand a delay up to about the half the distance between one symbol and that same symbol coming in. If it's really close, it's pretty good. If it then finds itself being one distance of one symbol out, which is one symbol is 92 nanoseconds, as it approaches a distance of 92 nanoseconds, the third generation equalizer really has a rotten time trying to figure out what it's got to do. A fifth generation equalizer can actually get to not only 92 nanoseconds, but one symbol that's exactly the distance of a symbol away, but it will actually go to another 45 nanoseconds and still be able to figure it out. So what that really means is that the later generations of equalizers are getting better at determining what to look at and what to ignore. And as you rotate your antenna, if you were to look at the signal that's actually at the RF portion, it should look like a very flat top thing with a little bit of a pilot. As you rotate the antenna, and you see that thing on top will begin to tilt. I don't know how to explain that really in English, because that's a phenomenon that a lot of people don't really understand. K2RW, K2J.
I think I might have a little bit of a problem of order of magnitude. When I was talking to a prominent person from the National Association of Broadcasters, and he told me about the latest generation of equalizer networks built into the digital converter, he was telling me they can tolerate plus and minus 75 microseconds. I wonder if he really meant plus or minus 75 nanoseconds. What do you think, Eric?
Reflection time turns out to be microseconds. The problem here is that if you were to take, say, the first symbol, all right, of the 8VSB signal and displace it a small amount, both of the equalizers are going to have a difficult time with it. The third generation equalizer is going to feel like really stupid about it, and the fifth generation equalizer is going to handle it. What they're talking about in terms of being able to have this large reflection issue is an easy task, because now the first symbol being 10 microseconds, 15 microseconds, 20 microseconds away, the decision feed forward equalizer, decision feedback equalizer, has a much easier time of trying to figure out which is the right symbol of the code.
Okay. A radar nautical mile is 6 microseconds of delay one way. 75 microseconds is 12 nautical miles. If I'm getting a delay between main bang and an echo signal of 12 miles. One path is 12 miles longer than the other and nearly equal in amplitude. Boy, the numbers are not coming out right in my mind. 75 nanoseconds, which is 75 feet of extra distance between main bang and multipath, easy. But 12 miles? I'm having trouble envisioning the environment that can make that much delay. Where am I going wrong here, Eric?
I'm going to get back to you, Dick. The station's calling me. I'll be back in a minute. K2RW, K2GI.
Very fine. Looking forward to you coming back. When it comes to these digital converter boxes, there's a lot more than meets the eye. But as I see it, Joe, interesting experiments you're doing. Kind of wish I was involved in this kind of jazz myself. Can't free up the time right now. But single strength is just unnecessary but not sufficient. The amount of multipath, the number of them, how strong are they, and how many nanoseconds of delay is another very big variable as to whether or not you do or do not get a clean demodulation. That's part of what's going on. And as the generations become higher and higher of these converter boxes that become available to us, I think they're going to have more and more tolerance of crazy signal conditions. There's a learning curve going on here as I see it. I think the problem of multipath is going to be worse on VHF frequencies than HF frequencies. That's my gut feel, because I think there's a lot more things that will present a significant bistatic radar cross-section. In other words, the amount of echo power you get from objects, I think in many cases, is going to be larger for VHF signals than UHF signals. And after December 17th, the Tuesday, the Black Tuesday, in theory, we all switch over to digital. But I'm hearing, because the Commerce Department ran out of money and wasn't able to continue issuing the coupons so that people can get a $40 rebate on the converters they buy, I think that Mr. Obama is pushing for a delay in the digital switchover until June. I'm hearing words along those lines. Whether or not Congress or FCC or whoever will actually give approval for that remains to be seen in the next couple of weeks. Let me turn it back to you, Joe. W2RYY, guy doing some interesting digital experiments, K2RYW on the TechNet.
Okay, the second part of the question was, what I measured, I just want to see if this sounds like it's sort of correct or not. Measuring with an HP8594, which had variable, I could change the resolution bandwidth. Say on a scan of a span width of 6 meg, the automatic resolution comes up to 30 kilohertz bandwidth. Video bandwidth, same thing. And sweep time is like 25 milliseconds, something like that, sweep time. I got a differential using trace hold of the pilot being at a certain amplitude and the rest of the noise that what you'd call bark head, which would actually change with multipathing or trees or whatever moving around making the signal, change the antenna. I saw that about 5 to 6 dB lower in amplitude. If I narrow the resolution bandwidth to, say, by a factor of 10 times, down to 3 kilohertz bandwidth, I saw about maybe 7 or 8 dB difference between the two signals. But I left it in the automatic mode to get to probably trying to get the most accurate reading. But that's what the second part of the question is. What is there an actual relationship between that pilot carrier, that 310 kilohertz from the bottom end of the channel, to the relationship of the rest of the noise that you see presented on the spectrum analyzer? What is that supposed to be as far as the power ratio?
Yeah, I've got a, trying to think of what it's called now, a PDF report from Gary Scrignoli, which shows the pictures of what the pilot should look like versus the rest of the bar's head for various resolution bandwidths on a well-calibrated spectrum analyzer. Because my internet service provider has failed, and I have no internet right now, there's no way I can ship it to you. But when I get back online, I'll try to ship you a copy. In other words, in his technical reports, he's got some beautiful color pictures taken off the screen of an analyzer showing this. As you go to broader and broader, let me backtrack. The nature of the Bart's head is that it's essentially like noise. In other words, it has a certain number of dBm of power per megacycle of bandwidth, or per kilohertz of bandwidth. So, up to 6 megacycles of resolution bandwidth as you go to broader and broader bandwidths on your res band of the spectrum analyzer, you're going to see more and more power. That's true of any noisy signal. If I'm looking at something that is white noise, really flat noise, coming out of a noise generator from, let's say, a automatic noise figure indicator, and I've got enough of a preamplification, so I've got the right sensitivity into the analyzer, every time I increase the bandwidth of resolution by 10 to 1, the total noise power I measure goes up exactly 10 dB. There's an exact relationship between bandwidth and noise power, because it has a noise power density. Density means dBm per megacycle or dBm per kilohertz. Noise does that. Whereas if you take a well-calibrated spectrum analyzer that's sweeping at the right rate, and you look at a pure tone signal coming out of a signal generator, whether you look at it with a 1 meg filter, a 300 kc filter, a 30 kc filter, a 1 kc filter, a 30 hertz filter, or a 10 hertz filter, you get the exact same power. A coherent CW sine wave signal behaves that way. It's got a specific power regardless of the bandwidth you observe it with. Whereas something that's Gaussian...
Repeater, timeout.
Something that's Gaussian noise-like in statistics and spread in megacycles, white noise in particular, and of course that's 6 megs, the 8 VSB signal is very similar to white noise. So, the noise power of the broadhead will go up with bandwidth. The pilot tone is essentially a tone like out of the signal generator, and it doesn't change. So the pictures I remember seeing from Gary Scrignoli's report is that as you go to a wide enough scan width, a res bandwidth, I meant, like say, for instance, 300 kc, you no longer see the pilot tone at all. The broadhead noise comes up and buries it. That's normal rules and laws of physics of the way a coherent signal and a broadband noise-like signal behave. So the fact that you see this difference with a scan width is exactly what you're supposed to see. Your real question is how many decibels of difference should you see for a particular res bandwidth? And that I don't know yet. Maybe Eric, when he comes back, does. I could pick it off of the graph from the Scrignoli report, and I think, but I'm not positive, that every digital transmitting broadcast station has, within a small window of difference, a rather exact relationship of pilot tone amplitude versus noise power density amplitude of all the other stuff that's in the 6 meg bandwidth. I think there's a quasi-standard there. However, depending on how much multipath you have, what you observe on your screen, I think, could differ. When Eric comes back, I'm going to ask him this question. Let's see if Eric is still there. KEQEJ, K2RIW on the TechNet. Yeah, I was kind of afraid of that. I think he got called away for a while. He's on call tonight. He's at his place of business. Joe, I'm hearing you on the input at 25146.25.
I'm back.
Aha. Eric is back. I wonder if you heard any of the questions with reference to pilot tone amplitude versus broadhead amplitude for a specific res bandwidth. I wonder if you've got an opinion on that one, with or without multipath. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, sorry, Dick. I just walked back in the room, so you want to repeat it.
Yeah, Joe has been observing on a good Hewlett-Packard 8594 spectrum analyzer. He's recognizing the fact that when he scans across the 6 megs and the machine automatically chooses the 30 kilohertz res bandwidth, he sees the pilot tone something like 5 dB above the noise of the broadhead. And as he goes to different res bandwidth, he sees different amounts of magnitude. Also, when he compares channel 22 to channel 23, even though one of those channels is stronger than the other, he sees some number of decibels of difference of pilot tone amplitude versus broadhead amplitude. Now, what I've been saying is that the broadhead stuff, the broadband stuff, is very similar to white noise. Every time you multiply the bandwidth by
2:1, you're going to get a 3 dB difference, or every time you multiply the bandwidth, the resolution bandwidth by 10:1, you're going to see 10 dB more signal. White noise behaves that way. And I very vaguely remember the Scrignoli pictures in one of his reports showing that if you use a res bandwidth that's wide enough, like 300 kHz, the pilot tone no longer is observable, per se. Or you get a very slight bump, but you can't really see it. Only when you get the more narrow res bandwidth does the pilot tone stick out. So one of Joe's questions is there a specific magnitude that every broadcast station might have, a pilot tone amplitude versus broadcast amplitude, when you restrict the exact res bandwidth of the spectrum analyzer? Or can there be a significant difference? And does multipath make the ratio look bigger? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K3J. All right, that's a bit of a tough question. Actually, what I need to do is to go find my book, and I can give you the exact values, the exact set of values between where the broadband noise is and how you measure it to the pilot. There's actually something in the FCC rules that specifies how you go about doing that. And you will find that depending upon who's manufacturer of the exciter, okay, you'll find some differences. There's not really supposed to be any, but it's, you know, they're all basically doing the same mathematical algorithm generating the 8BSB signal, but they do it in different ways. And some people do it in fast, in an FPGA, a bunch of them that run at clock cycles of sub-nanoseconds. Some of them do it at IF and bring it up and use a bit of a slower method. There's a lot of variables involved. Give me about a minute. Let me find my book. K2IW, K2J.
Okay. Hopefully you can hear me while you're looking for the book. And I, up till now, from listening to your conversations, Eric, had the impression that the so-called pilot tone is derived in a rather exacting mathematical procedure, algorithm, protocol, call it what you like, and therefore I suspect that there's going to be a rather small variation, like a fraction of a decibel, of amplitude of pilot tone versus broadhead noise, I'm going to call it noise, like signal, when you measure everything with a known res bandwidth filter. What you're saying right now is different manufacturers have different methods of deriving the pilot tone, therefore there could be a couple of dB of difference. That's one question, and as you were leaving the last time, I was asking how in the world could there be 75 microseconds of delay, which is 12 and a half nautical miles of difference in path length. I'm having a lot of trouble accepting that the real world can do that. If you, you know, within 20 decibels of the same amplitude between main signal and multipath signal, how in the world could one of them go through a path that is 12 and a half nautical miles longer and still come out similar in amplitude? I mean, the geometry of how that can come about. I mean, if one signal is bouncing off a huge billboard on top of a mountain off at 90 degrees from my path to the broadcast station, and I'm getting an indirect path that way, yeah, I can sort of see how one path can be 12 miles longer. But boy, you got to really work at that, and I don't think Mother Nature's going to do that for you. So I got a couple of questions there for you. We're going to be picking your brain quite a bit here tonight, Mayor Eric. Oh, we're glad you're on board. KE2EJ, if you've already come back, K2LAW in the tech net.
I need it in a minute. I'm looking for it. Hang on. Why don't you move on in a little bit, Malcolm? I'll be right back.
Okay. In the meantime, Joe, how come I'm hearing you on 146.25, the input to the machine, as opposed to coming through the internet like you normally do? Looks like you're making other equipment changes there. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
You're absolutely correct, and I'm full quality to repeater, aren't I? I also had a chance to measure a fill switch I just acquired, which is called an LPF 700. I can't seem to find one that cuts off at a little lower than that, because the filter does actually work pretty good. But it doesn't quite cut off as sharp as I would like it to cut off. It's they claim it's not cutting off past 700, but actually at 750 it's only 10 dB down. By the time you look at 800 megahertz, it's that 50 dB band. So it basically takes out the entire 800 meg band of cellular SMS trunking, all that kind of stuff you see up there, paging, all that stuff is 50, 60 dB down. So it basically worked pretty good as far as helping the amplifier, not going into overload, but couldn't find one that exactly cut off at 700 to do it with a sharp cutoff, so that's the best I've got so far.
And that doesn't surprise me. If I bought a low-pass filter, and I wanted a certain guaranteed performance up to 700 megs, and unless I give them some kind of a very specific spec as to how many decibels down the skirt's going to be at how many megacycles, unless I give them an exact spec like that, what you've observed is about the way a person would design a filter. In other words, you didn't see any significant roll-off until you got closer to 800 megs on a so-called 700 meg low-pass filter. Doesn't surprise me, because when a filter really starts rolling off, a couple things happen. Number one, it's not flat anymore. You're starting to get a decrease in signal. Number two, if you're measuring group delay distortion, you'll see that a bandpass filter, when plotted in group delay, looks like a rabbit ear performance. In other words, there's two great big spikes of rapidly changing nanoseconds of delay within the filter right at the beginning of the roll-off. So if you're trying to have a linear phase system across a particular frequency region, you'd like the roll-off to be somewhat removed in megacycles from where you're operating. Otherwise, in certain critical requirements, that group delay distortion is going to take a beautiful rectangular pulsed waveform that you're trying to produce and give it some other shape, tilts and rings and slopes and all kinds of funny things will happen. So that doesn't surprise me. To design a filter that gives you brick wall performance, you know, complete flat top up to 700 megacycles, and then 710 megacycles it rolls off like the hammers of hell, and doesn't have nasty performance characteristics at 700, that's an almost impossible filter. Let's see if Eric is back. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, K2RIW, K2EJ. Let me read to you a couple things here. We'll give you some thought about this. IEEE measurement recommendations, okay. When using a spectrum analyzer's channel power, you'll find that there are a lot of spectrum analyzers that are channeled out for television. Use RMS and video detection mode for best average power accuracy. If it's not available, use sample video detection mode for the next best average power approximation. Never use positive peak or negative peak. Use an analyzer with large dynamic range, you know, a large IP3, small DANL. Use an analyzer with a 5 dB internal step attenuator and correct for analyzer noise score mathematically. Right? Now here's what you want to do. The FCC is really more interested in how your channel mask is, so they're concerned about you banging into the next station up and down, since digital television allows for you not to have white spaces. It allows for you to have one channel next to each other. You can have a channel 30 and a channel 31, a channel 32, a channel 33, and as long as you get into the mask requirements, there's no problem there. And their approach to doing this, their method is as follows. The adjacent channel mask measurement method, right, and they're looking for minus 110 dB in relation to DTV. Method one is to calibrate a band stop filter, which is direct method, remove the in-band DTV signal energy with a sharp band stop, then carefully measure the 500 kHz subbands after both filters, mathematically correct for the band stop filter insertion loss, and compare that to the FCC emission mask for compliance. That's one way to go about it. The indirect method is to carefully measure and record a high power mask filter magnitude transfer function over an 18 megahertz span
measures signal splatter energy before the mask because you know it's fast. Mathematically apply the mask filter stop band attenuation to the splatter energy and then compare that to the mask. Now that's where the FCC is really putting their energy. They're not saying so much about the pilot or the difference in level and how it relates to where the top of the noise, the signal that you call the noise is. So that's where their focus is at the moment. So I'm going to look for the specifications for you exactly as to the level the signal is supposed to be at. I just got to find the right page here. K2RIWK2J.
Okay. You said quite a mouthful, and you came into a number of the areas that I had a significant amount of grief until we dug into the specifics of using a Hewlett-Packard 8566 spectrum analyzer when measuring broad Gaussian noise jamming windows out of a jammer transmitter that we were designing at my previous salt mine. Some of the problems you run into is that, first of all, a barefoot spectrum analyzer in its most sensitive band, without a preamplifier installed, the most sensitive band is usually the so-called direct conversion band when it only uses the fundamental mixing mode, roughly between 2 and 4 gigahertz. There it has something like a 30 decibel noise figure. And on the other bands where it has to use another mixer cascaded, like to get the band 0 to 2 gigs, there's one more mixer installed, and therefore it's got something more like a 40 decibel noise figure. So whether or not you're seeing noise of the spectrum analyzer, as opposed to noise coming in the front end, which is or is not being preamplified, the paragraph that Eric read is that you have to evaluate how much of the noise on the screen is analyzed the noise, how much of it is from the device under measurement, like a broadcast transmitter sampling port, and you have to mathematically correct between the two. And that's done as a power relationship. Second of all, a Hewlett-Packard 8566, when you first turn it on, it wakes up in the Rosenfeld mode. And I'll explain what that mean is. Rosenfeld is not a man's name. It's past tense of rise and fall. Back in the days when they first converted from a cathode ray tube display, where you normally see the noise on the screen because the IF strip signal has Gaussian noise going through a logarithmic IF filter. The video output is therefore jumping up and down, and the display jumps up and down on the cathode ray tube and the way you're deflecting that beam. As soon as you go from a cathode ray tube display to a digital matrix display, a display matrix, and then you sample those signals and you display it on the screen in a different manner.
Repeater, timeout.
All hell breaks loose. The machine does a bunch of sampling. You break up the screen horizontally into 1,024 vertical stripes. So as the beam is sweeping across the screen, it goes to position number 1, position number 2, and eventually position number 1,024. 2 to the 10 power is the digitally selected horizontal positioning of your display. And the same thing with vertical. So you got the 1,024 possible positions in vertical and 1,024 horizontal. And you take the noise that you've sampled. During the time you're scanning across the first of the 1,024 channels, you're taking 06, 8, 10 samples of noise power, averaging them, and displaying them on the screen. If you just did it directly, the noise looks smooth, and the people who have for years and years been looking at noise, and it fills up 10 dB of peak to valley on the screen, they said something's wrong. That ain't noise. I don't believe it. Hewlett-Packard got around the problem by forcing it to look like noise during the odd horizontal sample channels between 1,000 and 24. On the odd samples, they sample peak amplitudes of the 6 samples they take. On the even channels, they sample the valley amplitudes. Now, if you look with a magnifying glass real close to the screen, you would see all the odd channels are high and all the even channels are low. But when you back off more than a couple of inches, it looks jagged, it looks like noise, and people are happy. of the statistics of what's being displayed as noise and the real world statistics is something very different. By pressing the buttons on the front panel of that 8566, you can force it to go